about the Lower Columbia. And at 11:30 on the film show, a visit to the new micro cinema at the Portland International Airport, which features short films and videos by Oregon directors. It's 8:59, and Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell is next.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Good morning. This is Press Watch. News you're not supposed to know. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Going to have an hour to talk about various topics, and I have a white terror report, a brief one, and a war report. And if you'd like to call in with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. Start with the white terror report. I wasn't reaching were the last words of Philando Castile. I wasn't reaching. Wasn't reaching for the gun that he told the officer that he had. I suppose now we've all heard that story. And now Charlena Lyles was shot to death pregnant in front of her children in Seattle after killing two and injuring one on the train and throwing a knife at a cop car. Oh, no, wait, that was a white guy. The Philando Castile jury was stacked with pro-gun, pro-cop, middle-aged white people, according to an article by Callie Holloway in Alternet. And she writes, dash cam footage of the exact moment Philando Castile was murdered by Minnesota police Geronimo Yanez was released late Tuesday. The video proves two things. Castile could not have been more compliant, and Yanez responded to that compliance with violence and seven rounds of gunfire. There is no ambiguity in the footage or the audio. No doubt that Yanez was unqualified to be carrying that gun. No question, he was a far greater danger to Minnesota's citizens than the man he killed. To watch that scene and not believe Philando Castile was murdered is to believe black life has no inherent life, no inherent right to exist. The jury was shown the footage, she writes, several times over the course of Yanez's criminal trial, yet they chose to acquit him on all charges. It's a verdict that's maddeningly, infuriatingly, and heartbreakingly illogical, yet consistent with the outcome in every case of the cops who are tried for killing innocent black people. The U.S. system of criminal injustice fails black folks from start to finish by design. A more intimate look at the jurors in Yanez's criminal case, compiled by a Minneapolis Star Tribune, offers not only insights into how they arrived at their decision, but a look at just how well stacked the jury was against a just verdict for Castile. She writes, there were just two black people on the jury of Castile's supposed peers. Juror one was a young African-American man who works as a shift manager at Wendy's and a personal care attendant for his mom. He expressed some lack of faith in the criminal justice system, reportedly expressing a belief that the wealthy and powerful could get off in the legal system because they could hire better attorneys. Juror 8 was an 18-year-old Ethiopian-American who has lived in the U.S. since age 10. The Tribune notes that the defense tried to strike her due to unfamiliarity with the U.S. legal system, but the judge denied the attempt. The rest of those selected for the jury were overwhelmingly middle-aged white Minnesotans, many of whom expressed stated support, expressly stated support for police or a belief in the infallibility of the criminal justice system. Here's how the list shakes out. Taken directly from the Star Tribune, Juror 2. An older white female who manages a White Bear Lake gas station that has a contract with police. She said she had never heard of the Castile case. The judge denied an attempt by prosecutors to strike her after it was revealed that she had pro-police posts on her Facebook page. One of those posts was heavily critical of NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick, who began kneeling during national anthems last year to protest police shootings. She said she had forgotten about the posts. Juror 3. Middle-aged white male whose wife works for the St. Paul School District, as did Castile, but she did not know him. He lives very close to where Castile was shot and works as the number one guy at a small metal finishing shop. He said his father was a fire chief and he grew up around law enforcement and also has a nephew who is a police officer. He said it would be difficult for him to be unbiased. He has a permit to carry and says he knew to keep his hands visible during a traffic stop. That's what they teach you, he said. Juror 4, a middle-aged white male who had very little knowledge of the case. He said he owns a gun and called the criminal justice system a very fair process. Juror 5, a middle-aged white female who works at an assisted living center and is highly active in church volunteer work. She said she had heard about the shooting at the time it happened but knew little else. Her husband was carjacked at gunpoint 18 years ago. She said she had a high regard for police. Juror 6, a white male in his 40s who is a jury foreperson and a wellness coach for the last 7 years. He believes too many victimless crimes are prosecuted, including drug use and sex work. He believes marijuana should be legalized. He said he was somewhat isolated and knew nothing about the Yanez case. Juror 7, a white female in her late 30s, early 40s, who works as a nurse at the same hospital as Yanez's wife, but said she does not know her. She said she watched Diamond Reynolds' Facebook video, but didn't seek out news about the case and knew a moderate amount about it. She's a member of a Harley motorcycle group. She said she was dissatisfied with how police responded to a call in 1996. Juror 9, a middle-aged computer support worker. She was not familiar with Yanez's case and said, I'm thankful we have police officers. She believes in the right to own a firearm, but added, I'm trying to stay away from them right now. Juror 10, a middle-aged white male who has retired from pre-printing work and said he followed news about the case off and on. He said he had seen Reynolds' Facebook video, quoting, she seemed overly calm, end quote. That's him on his juror questionnaire. He owns a handgun and hunts. Juror 11, a middle-aged white male who owns several shotguns and long rifles to hunt pheasants. A former business manager who now works in construction and remodeling, he said in his questionnaire that the criminal justice system has problems, but is the best in the world. Juror 12, a middle-aged white male who moved to Minnesota 4 years ago to get a new start. He said he's a regular listener to Minnesota Public Radio who knew a lot about the case. A pipe fitter, he took a permit to carry class 3 months ago. Keep your hands visible and do not do anything until they tell you want, that's a direct quote, to do. He said of the permit to carry education, permit to carry education on traffic stop conduct. He believes minor criminal offenses snowball and trap people in the justice system. It seems like it's rigged against you, he said. So she writes, justice for Philando Castile never had a chance. The system isn't broken. In fact, it's working exactly the way it's supposed to. And the Yanez case is yet more evidence of exactly how well it continues to function. That's the article by Collie Holloway, senior writer and associate editor of Media and Culture at alternet.org. And I recommend a rereading of that article. I have been advocating a new system, a better world, a revolution here in the United States for some time, but it's impossible to move forward on any issue, on even the most basic issues that afflict us, climate change, war, as long as we are divided against ourselves, as long as our fellow citizens are targeted for their skin color, as long as people who are designated as white, pale-skinned people like me, as long as we pale-skinned people pretend this isn't happening, pretend that we do not live in a police state that is racially charged with animus against people of color, as long as we pretend that these police shootings are an aberration and not an outcome of grotesquely unaddressed racial injustice, then we cannot move forward. We cannot have a revolution. We cannot address climate change. We can't do anything until we do something about this. Black Lives Matter. Number to comment with your call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Now we'll talk about the wider wars. The U.S. and its co-conspirators are fanning the flames of war on several fronts today, notably Syria, Afghanistan, where there was another car bomb, Qatar, and the Koreas. All of these countries, save Qatar, are occupied by United States troops. Iraq is also still occupied, although we don't like to admit it, but I'll have more on that in a minute. In Syria, the Russians, allied with the government of Syria and acting on a mutual defense pact, have notified the United States that they will no longer answer the special de-escalation hotline, deconfliction hotline, that had been in place to prevent the outbreak of active hostilities between nuclear-armed Russia and nuclear-armed United States. They said that the U.S., whereas it claimed to have used the deconfliction line before the shootdown, did not. The Russians also said that they would shoot down U.S. planes if they crossed to the Russian-protected side of the Euphrates River. The degradation of relations began after the U.S. shot down a Syrian jet earlier this month and was trying to bomb the Kurdish militia that the U.S. is currently supporting in a failing assault on Raqqa. And I might be wrong, it might be mostly, Wahhabist Syrian factions or other Syrian factions that the U.S. is currently supporting. Raqqa is the sixth largest city in Syria. And of course, the Syrian government wants it back under their control, while the U.S. is interested in continuing to weaken the area, the oil-rich area, I should say, with anti-Iranian factions. The war in Syria, a true horror that has produced the biggest number of refugees since the Second World War, is now devolving from a multi-party civil war and regional conflict into confrontation between Iran, Syria, and Russia on one side, and the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and de facto Kurdistan on the other. Meanwhile, interested parties in Saudi Arabia continue to fund the Islamic State Wahhabist militias, which still maintain large areas under occupation. Arms dealers and oil speculators continue to rake in record profits. This from the Syria War Report. On Sunday, a U.S. F-A-18 Super Hornet shot down a Syrian Air Force Sukhoi-22 warplane near Jadin in the western part of the province of Raqqa. Jadin is located in the area south of the town of Tabqa, controlled by U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces. That's the SDF. You need to know these abbreviations. SDF, Syrian Democratic Forces. If you're going to follow the war at all, which the United States does not want you to do, then you need to know some of these things. The Syrian Arab Army, for example, is abbreviated SAA. And, of course, you've heard of ISIS, the Islamic State. At 6:43 p.m., they write, a Syrian regime SU-22 dropped bombs near SDF fighters south of Tabqa, and in accordance with rules of engagement and collective self-defense of coalition-partnered forces, was immediately shot down by a U.S. F-A-18E Super Hornet. That's a quote from the U.S.-led coalition. In turn, the Syrian Defense Ministry, they write, said that the attack was an attempt to undermine the SAA effort, that's the Syrian government's effort, against ISIS. The U.S. attack came amid the rapid Syrian advance in the Rasafa area. With the liberation of Rasafa, the Syrian army, the SAA, controls one of the important roads heading to Deir ez-Zor, besieged by ISIS terrorists. In this case, the U.S. move is another attempt to draw red lines for the internationally recognized government of Syria. Washington sees successful SAA operations against ISIS as a threat to U.S. influence in the war-torn country. Incidentally, I agree with that analysis. I don't agree with a lot of analysis from this particular source. They are grotesquely trans and homophobic, but you need a source of information about what's actually happening in Syria, and you're not getting it from U.S. corporate-owned media. So I will continue with this report, which you can find at thesoccer.is. That's S-A-K-E-R, referring to a falcon, thesoccer.is. Following the incident, the Iranian Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, that's the IRGC, another acronym you need to know, IRGC, Iranian Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, launched medium-range ground-to-ground missiles at ISIS targets in the Syrian province of Deir Ezzor, according to the IRGC. The missiles were launched from the western Iranian provinces of Kermanshah and Kurdistan, flew through Iraq's airspace, and hit terrorist targets in Syria. Iran reportedly used Zulfikar missiles. So I'm going to depart from that for just a moment and ask you to think about it. Think about that for a moment. Iran fired missiles from its territory, flew through U.S.-controlled Iraqi airspace, and I mean really U.S.-controlled Iraqi airspace, and hit targets in Syria. Here's a quote from Wikipedia. President Obama announced the full withdrawal of troops from Iraq as previously scheduled on 21st of October 2011. The U.S. retained an embassy in Baghdad with some 17,000 personnel, consulates in Basra, Mosul, and Kirkuk, which have been allocated more than 1,000 staff each, and between 4,000 and 5,000 defense contractors. Why did I switch to Iraq? Because these missiles flew over Iraq. Those 17,000 personnel, those 5,000 defense contractors, in other words, mercenaries, operate radar systems, among other things, and they knew that those missiles were going over. What was Iran saying? A lot of things. They're saying that we have a lot of missiles. We can aim them where we want, and they hit where they're supposed to. And yeah, we could aim those easily and with a shorter range at the U.S. massive occupation compound, laughingly called an embassy in Baghdad. So returning to the text, the IRGC statement said that the missile strike was a response to the recent ISIS-claimed terrorist attack in Tehran. However, it's clear that this missile strike was a message to the U.S.-led coalition and U.S.-backed forces in Syria. The missile strike shows that Iran is capable of conducting a missile strike on joint garrisons of the U.S. coalition, U.S.-led coalition forces and U.S.-backed militant groups located near the villages of Attanf and Al-Skuf at the border with Iraq. Meanwhile, according to some sources, sporadic firefights appeared between the Syrian Arab Army and the Syrian Defense Forces south of Topka, after the SDF had opposed government forces' attempt to conduct a pilot rescue operation in the area. So, again, speaking for myself, they shot down the plane, and it wasn't easy to rescue their pilot. Reports also appeared that a U.S.-led coalition of forces, they write, are setting up a military facility in the town of Topka. U.S. forces are reportedly aiming to build a command center and residential buildings for its troops. According to opposition sources, the U.S. wants to adopt the new base as a long-term base in Syria. Once again, speaking for myself, this is significant. This means that probably U.S. construction brigades, the CBs you may have read about that could construct an air base within a couple of days in World War II, where were they when Hurricane Katrina hit Louisiana? Well, they were in Baghdad building the occupation compound, and now I suspect that they are in this town in Syria. This is a widespread war, a widening war, a threatening war. It is drawing in Iran and its ally Russia. You need to know about it. You need details. There's a bit of a buzz, I realize. I kind of feel it myself when I'm reading these horrifying statements about fighting and shooting. And what it doesn't say, of course, is that it's driving people out of their homes, it's tearing people apart, it's shooting everyone dead, it's killing whole families. It's an absolute brutal horror, and you're paying for it. So what do you think about that? 503-231-8187. Do you support the war in Syria? If so, I'd like to know why. And Mike's on the air.
Hello?
Hello. What's up, Mike?
Yeah, I want to go back to that police shooting.
Yes.
That you were talking about. You know, first of all, I want to use this quote that Frederick Douglass said. He said, find out what a person or a group of people will quietly submit to, and you know the extent of your domination. Now,
and he would know.
Black people, and he would know. And black people as a whole, they're apolitical now. Back in the day, like, say, when Rodney King, he just got beat up by the police, but the response to that was they almost tore L.A. apart. There was mass rioting. Now police are shooting all these black people, and the only thing that comes out of it is rhetoric. They go to court, they know what's going to happen, and then after that, they expound on the injustices, and that's the extent of it. I remember when I was coming up, the Black Panther Party was around. They wasn't shooting black people like that then. And when black people quit going into the street, tearing up stuff, when they were doing that, the police wasn't shooting black people because now it wasn't financially feasible, because they know that black people was going to tear up a city or something. So that's all I'm trying to say, is that you're not going to change the system through rhetoric. You got to change the institutions. And if you're not talking about changing the institutions, then everything else is futile.
It makes me wonder, what are people forced to do? I mean, you know, I can't know, because I'm not subject to this. I am transgender, and so I get a little taste of it, but not the same. And I wonder what can a people do? What can people do when they have absolutely no choice? In the past, in history, they've turned to other nations. And so I wonder, you know, is it appropriate? And the UN certainly recognizes this under severe oppression. It's appropriate to find help, even military help, for your liberation movement from another country. And so are people of color in this country being forced to turn elsewhere to the Chinese or some other place for help?
Well, you know, I don't know. I haven't looked at that aspect of it. What I do know is that black people have to, I think, return to being militant. They have to become political again. Back in the day, even the music that was put out by black artists was instructional, it was political. Now the rap is, you know, it ain't about politics, anything like that. Black people have become complacent. See, the worst position to put somebody in is when they have nothing to lose and everything to gain. And black people think they got everything to lose and nothing to gain, so they want to try to work within the system. You can't work within the framework. I mean, Huey Newton, Elders Cleaver, all of these people say it is exactly the framework that I'm trying to overthrow. But black people, the first thing they want to do is work within the framework. The framework ain't designed for you. So we have lost that militancy. And a lot in this generation wasn't around to see it. I saw it. You know, gentrification in Northeast Portland would have never took place back in the day, because black people was militant. They had the Black Panther Party over there. They used to ride and monitor the police, and they would show up armed. And so the police know that there was a reckoning. Nowadays, there's no reckoning, because we got these pseudo-intellectuals. We got these black people that are trying to simulate and get along. And so what happened? They get kicked to the curb every time, because the only thing they come out with is rhetoric. You know, talk is cheap. Anyway, right, man, that's my take on it.
Well, thank you very much for your opinion. Number call 503-231-8187. Had been talking about the white terror and the latest, of course, the shooting of a pregnant woman in front of her kids in Seattle. Had also been talking about the wider war against the world projected. You know, the Trump administration has been a real wake-up call for me. It's kind of hard to say exactly in what way. It's like I knew that this tendency was here in the United States, but being a white person, I did not experience just how common it was, just how powerful it was, until 60 million Americans voted to throw people of color under the bus on the off chance that a complete lunatic and a fool could lead the nation to a better place economically. And it was a hell of a shock, as it is for many of you listening to me now. And it's easier to focus on this now. It's like I don't kid myself. 60 million is something that you can't. I mean, I pointed out shortly after the election and before Greg Palast reports that the election was stolen, and it was, but it was a near thing. People were disgusted with the Democratic Party's corporate slant. They did not come out to vote as they had before, and the Republicans won it, I won't say fair and square, but they got about half the votes, I'd say. Pretty close, a little short, and they have absolutely no ethics in that regard, and I would say the Democratic Party also has very little. That's why the Democratic Party's fight back has been in the mostly false, I would say, frame of saying that the Russians threw the election with the Trump administration's or with the Republican Party's help, or the Russians threw the election outside the efforts. That's really not substantially true. I think it will eventually come out. I don't know that it will be within a useful political frame or not, but it will eventually come out that Russian interference was not particularly significant, and the Republicans' long-term strategy of gerrymandering, poll closure, digital ballot reversal, et cetera, is what really stole the election. But then again, confronted with the fact that 60 million Americans basically voted that regime in, and that regime has now the power of all of those votes. This is why you don't hear impeachment proceedings moving forward. It really doesn't matter that there are impeachable offenses, because something like 80 high 70s or mid 80s percentage of Republicans in Congress support the Trump administration. Why? They like power. So they're not going to budge. They have the power. It doesn't matter that they got it illegitimately. And they're going to keep it. It's not going to move. And the 60 million I was talking about also support U.S. wars and are incurious, uninterested in the details, because, well, they're just uninterested, basically. They've been trained to be uninterested, and they now are for generations. So I'm trying to counter that with this detailed information of what's actually going on in the world. And as I was saying, tensions are building up over Syria as the U.S. is confronting Iran and Russia. And right now, today, there's no deconfliction line. The Russians are saying that they will shoot down U.S. planes under certain circumstances, and the U.S. Troop commitment is increasing in Syria. We are at war with Syria. What do you think of that? 503-231-8187. And the latest is that the U.S. shot down an Iranian drone in the area this week, escalating the regional power conflict. Now, this takes place as a weird phenomenon goes on in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, where they have cut off food and other supplies to the nation of Qatar, or as they often say on U.S. news services, Qatar, demanding that it essentially give up its sovereignty and buckle under to a list of political demands. The reason I say give up its sovereignty is that the list of demands is not made explicit. Basically, they just want Riyadh, the Saudi Arabian rulers, just want Qatar to give up being a sovereign state and to buckle under to them. And one of the things they demanded was the silencing of its international news service, Al Jazeera. One might expect the United States to rein in its principal arms purchaser in the region, Saudi Arabia, but under the idiotic administration of the Trump regime, it's not clear what is to be done versus the rabid demands of the Saudis. Qatar hosts the Al Udeid Air Base, which could be used to bring in supplies. The airbase is essential to U.S. projection of military power in the region. You need to know how big this base is. Here's a description from Wikipedia of the base in Qatar, the base in Qatar. Quoting, Al Udeid Air Base is a military base southwest of Doha, Qatar, also known as Abu Nakhla Airport. It houses both Qatari Air Force, U.S. Air Force, and other coalition personnel and assets. It is host to Forward Headquarters of the United States Central Command, Headquarters of the United States Air Force's Central Command, Number 83 Expeditionary Air Force Group, RAF, Royal Air Force, and 379th Air Expeditionary Wing of the United States Air Force. In 1999, the then Emir of Qatar, Sheikh Hamad, told U.S. officials that he would like to see as many as 10,000 servicemen permanently stationed at Uadid. And according to media reports, in June 2017, he got his wish because the base is hosting 11,000 U.S. and U.S.-led coalition forces and over 100 operational aircraft. So it's a giant base. It's essential to the U.S. wars in the region. And weirdly, or perhaps with some aim that I haven't divined, the U.S. is allowing Saudi Arabia and its more or less puppet Bahrain to bully them. This also from Al Jazeera. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has said that Washington hopes that Saudi Arabia and its Gulf allies will soon present Qatar a list of reasonable and actionable demands to move the diplomatic crisis towards a resolution. Here's a quote of Tillerson. We understand a list of demands has been prepared and coordinated by the Saudis, Emiratis, Egyptians, and Bahrainis. We hope the list of demands will soon be presented to Qatar and will be reasonable and actionable, end quote. So speaking for myself, we hope. Well, there was a time when the U.S. Had much more, let's say, sway over Saudi Arabia than to say we hope. But anyway, Tillerson says the United States backs a Kuwaiti mediation effort aimed at resolving the crisis. His comments came a day after the State Department said it was mystified that Gulf states had not yet offered the grievances that prompted a rift with Qatar. Quoting Heather Nairt, spokesperson for the State Department, at this point, we are left with one simple question. Were the actions really about their concerns regarding Qatar's alleged support for terrorism, or were they about the long simmering grievances between and among the Gulf Cooperation Council countries? End quote. On Wednesday, the spokesman for Qatar's foreign ministry said Doha welcomed the State Department's stance. He reaffirmed Qatar's strategic stance that supports solving the crisis by civilized dialogue. So this is from Al Jazeera. Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Egypt severed diplomatic ties and cut off sea and air links with Qatar on June 5th, accusing it of supporting terrorism, a charge Doha strongly denies. And speaking for myself, this is an act of war. This is air, sea, and land blockade. They ordered, going back to the text, they ordered Qatari nationals to leave their countries and urge their citizens to return to their respective nations, disrupting the lives of thousands in the region and restricting their freedom of movement. And again, speaking for myself, part of that is code for how are we going to do the Hajj? How are we going to get into Saudi Arabia and do our pilgrimage if they're going to treat us like this? Turkey. The latest is that Turkey is sending food supplies to Qatar by sea on Wednesday. That's yesterday, to compensate for a recent embargo by Qatar's neighbor states. This is rather brave on their part. In an exclusive interview with Anadolu Agency with Al Jazeera, a spokesman said that nearly 105 cargo planes have already carried food from Turkey to Qatar. But he said, however, it is not economical or sustainable to send foodstuff by plane. The minister stated that further shipments will follow Wednesday's batch, adding that the Turkish products started to be delivered also by land. So they are defying the embargo, and we'll just see how that works out, because as we know, the Saudis are very heavily armed by your tax dollars, and they may attack. We don't know things. And now let me just ratchet that up a little further about this war that you're not informed about, this act of war by a U.S. ally that you get very little information about, and the general context. The U.S. has buzzed the Russian defense minister's plane. The U.S. has sent out a plane to harass a Russian plane, which was escorted by jets. This is from antiwar.com. Jason Deitz writes, Russian Defense Minister Shoigu's plane was reportedly carrying the defense minister and a number of reporters to a conference in the Russian enclave of Kaliningrad between Poland and Lithuania. The plane was reportedly escorted by a pair of Su-27s, and the F-16 fighters were scrambled, claiming the plane with the defense minister on board was not identified and that they were trying to make a visual identification. Now, speaking for myself, this is absolutely ridiculous. They could see on radar that it was escorted, as if they didn't know from intelligence anyway. Not that they would need intelligence. It would be openly stated, the flight plans of all the planes anyway. Returning to the text, when one of the fighters started getting too close to the Shoigu's plane, and you should go on YouTube and see this, a Sukhoi 27 flew in between the two and tilted its wings, apparently to underscore that it was armed with anti-aircraft weapons, at which time the F-16 flew off. That's not sitting well with Russia at all, as Defense Committee Chairman Vladimir Shamanov, who was also the former commander of Russian airborne forces, condemned the incident as military rudeness on NATO's part. Shamanov insisted it should have been readily apparent when the F-16 arrived that a civilian plane with an escort of multiple Su-27s was carrying protected persons and that approaching the plane would be considered unacceptable. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. And Francis is on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I appreciate your discussion this morning, and all of this just reinforces my belief that this is all kinds of perpetrating of conflict just to keep the war industry going and at the expense of the people. But if I remember correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, but when the current president was over and they signed this new arms bill with an agreement with Saudi Arabia, I don't know, billions of dollars.
Yes.
And then shortly after that, there was this announcement that Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates and everything all of a sudden had a problem with Qatar. And now they're doing what they're doing with Qatar. But
it does seem to follow on, doesn't it?
But then we have an air base in Qatar. And also, within just a few days after that discussion, I heard that we signed a new arms agreement with Qatar. So, I mean, whose side are we on? Whoever's making conflicts so we can make more money, it seems.
It's just bizarre, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, it's
makes you ask who's in charge.
It's corporate wars to keep them rolling in the dough.
I guess. I mean, imperialism doesn't have to make sense, but that does make sense. I mean, and I agree with your assessment. I mean, the arms industry is so gigantic, has such momentum, hires so many people. I was looking at photographs of the inside of the U.S. embassy, and again, I say that word is used jokingly, the massive occupation compound in Baghdad, and it is deluxe. It was a military contractor's dream. It's a multi-billion dollar effort, and it's kind of a visual hint as to the attitude of the United States generally. It's this island in Baghdad, unapproachable, surrounded by massive, thick concrete and steel blast walls, where this little version of America exists. On Christmas, they have a big Christmas tree and a huge marble lobby.
And mommies and everybody are being killed and maimed and traumatized.
Shredded, but not inside that compound.
And I just think the short-term profit thing has gotten way out of control. It's almost like it's mechanical. And it seems that we just need to do a little teeny shift in the paradigm and find another way for these people to make all this money besides perpetrating conflict.
I think you're right. I think it's part of toxic masculinity, actually, at this point. Short-term profit makes you the big man.
Right, but it's so absurd in the long run. It's just really, it's illogical and absurd. But I don't know, maybe we can find a way for them to make money by doing things to make children happy, you know? I don't know. Does it have to be conflict that they make money from? Can't they think of something else?
I can think of something else.
Anyway, I appreciate the conversation this morning.
Thanks for calling in.
Take care.
The number to call, 503-231-8187. 8187, 503-231-8187. I've been talking about just how extensive and how dangerous the widespread wars are becoming. These are wars that certainly are in place and escalated in places under the Obama administration, previous to that by the Bush administration, previous to that by other administrations. It's been going on really on an accelerated basis after the genocide of the Indians since 1898. The game, part of the game, is to make sure that you do not know what's going on so that there cannot be an outbreak of democracy. An outbreak of democracy would be disastrous to the United States as it now stands. It is not a democracy. It is an oligarchy of the very rich and of their dedicated industries, the oil industry, the war industry, the finance industry. And right now, the confrontations with the Russians are becoming more and more irrational. As I was saying, that there was an incident, a deliberate incident by the U.S. Sending out an interceptor plane to an escorted civilian aircraft liner carrying Russian Defense Minister Shoigu. And in addition to that, I can turn to RT.com, Russia Today, where you can... you can link to Russia Today or Sputnik or, as I mentioned before, the soccer, and you will then be tracked by the NSA. But I've done it for you, so you can listen on Free People's Radio, KBOO Portland, and they write, on Shoigu's way back from Kaliningrad, his escort was bolstered by several Sukhoi 34 jets, a much more modern jet, according to reporters. A number of NATO planes followed the defense minister's plane at a distance without making any attempts to get closer. On Monday, a U.S. RC-135 spy plane flying towards the Russian border made a provocative turn towards the Baltic Fleet Sukhoi 27, which had been scrambled for an interception mission. And speaking for myself, that's legitimate. You have interception missions to defend your territory, of course. But returning to the article from Russia Today, the encounters of Russian and U.S. warplanes over the Baltic Sea waters have apparently become more frequent lately. A Russian fighter jet intercepted a small group of U.S. warplanes, including a Boeing KC-135 Strato tanker, military refueling aircraft, two B-1 bombers, and one B-52. During the Baltic Operations annual training exercise on June 10th, earlier in June, the Russian military intercepted another B-52 bomber in the same area and escorted by a Sukhoi 27 fighter away from Russian territory. So this madness is increasing. And as I mentioned before, the Iranians have been retaliating with missiles. And I don't know that I was this explicit. Maybe I was. But the Iranians could kick up one hell of a war against the U.S. war effort in the Middle East with their long-range rocketry. That's what they've been developing all this time. Doing everything. I mean, they, for example, have sent turtles into outer space. A bizarre thing, but it's part of their scientific experimentation and effort to demonstrate to the world that they have the power and the accuracy to deliver their missiles. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. The important news about North Korea is not the incident of the comatose tourist, as one might reasonably suppose from corporate U.S. media. The news is that China has been pressuring the U.S. to accept some version of the deal being offered by North Korea to suspend its nuclear tests on the condition that the U.S. suspend its vast and threatening war games in the area. President Moon Jae-in of South Korea is also very much interested in a deal. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, however, is not responding directly to the offer. As a matter of fact, he is willing to go a long way to establish, Moon is willing to go a long way to establish a lasting peace. More on that in a moment, because Sean has called in. The number to call, 503-231-8187. Good morning, Sean.
Hey, good morning, Teresa. Yeah, wouldn't all that Russian plane nonsense be tied into GPS systems? I'm just throwing that generality.
Oh yeah, I
out
mean
there
yes, it is impossible, I mean, almost impossible that they would not know that a civilian airliner with two Sukhoi 27 jets was not an escorted.
Right, and my point to that is because the whole GPS system is run by whom? It's run by the Department of Defense out of Colorado.
Yeah.
So they know. So my main point in calling, I wanted to follow up on what Frances said, which I agree with her, was the timing of the funding to more funding to Saudi Arabia of everything militarily, and then going after Qatar. And I just want to point out that, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, the essence is, as Upton Sinclair said, in the jungle, they're nothing but pirates and murderers. And, you know, the MIC, Military Congressional Complex, has everything to do with this. And if you look at the strategic location of Qatar, it sits right out in the middle of the Persian Gulf. And when you look at the size of the military complex on Qatar, and it sits right across from Iran, so you've got the flow of oil through there. And what really bothers me about this whole ongoing storyline of the so-called U.S.-backed but Saudi-led war in Yemen is nobody ever really talks about why is this all happening in Yemen. And it's the same thing. Yemen sits right on the Gulf of Aden, sits in that pinch point into the Red Sea, sits right across from Djibouti, which has all sorts of military. Basically, Djibouti is nothing but a sitting point for numerous military installations from different Western European countries.
Yeah, I can see over the decades that the plan, oh, let's see, what was his name? Brzezinski was part of this. The plan to balkanize the entire region, to weaken it so that oil companies could be the dominant player,
exactly,
has been moving apace. And all of these actions support that. I mean, it seems confusing because it's like, who is the U.S. supporting? Are we bombing ISIS or are we supporting ISIS? Well, both.
And both.
That tears up the place and eventually will allow for cheap oil extraction by Exxon and Chevron.
Right. I mean, first of all, I want to say is that this whole thing of, you know, they say we're against this country, but then we fund them with more military and financial. I just want to point, anybody who has not read The Shadow World by Andrew Feinstein should, because that is a most telling book on the global arms trade. And this whole, they fund both sides. They do not hesitate because it's all about profit.
The shadow world inside the global arms trade.
Politics and all of that has nothing to do with it. It's all about making money off the war trade, from the largest of Lockheed right down to the smallest, criminals who just get into the arms trade on their own, selling used bullets from Albania and that kind of thing. So, I mean, it's not really as so-called, it's insane, but it makes perfect sense in terms of what their mentality is. So, but I agree, it's all been balkanized, but for the most part, this is really being run by the small clique of the MIC and corporatism.
I have to agree. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks.
Time is 9:46. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO. I'm Teresa Mitchell. This is the news you're not supposed to know. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia with the brilliant Chris Andre. Headlines, interviews, and commentary at 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock this morning, we'll have Kathleen Stevenson on air again, welcoming Victoria Stopiello to discuss her collection of essays, This Side of Sand Island, Reflections on Fish Fins and Finding Out About the Lower Columbia. That is called Between the Covers. It's coming up at 11, and at 11:30, the film show will have a visit to the new Micro Cinema at the Portland International Airport, which features short films and videos by Oregon directors. And I'd like to read this blurb. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. And I ask you to do that. That's how we get by. That's our funding model that is absolutely the core, and it has kept us honest all these years. It has kept us trying to find out the truth. I'm pretty proud of what the news department is doing right now in terms of cranking up investigative reporting, and I think you will hear results of that more than you have even in the past, in the coming years. And you can support that, you really should, to keep us honest, to keep us on the air, to keep us going out worldwide as a media hub. With all of the podcasts that we have on kboo.fm, just open a tab, take a second, and just tag us with a few bucks. It's easy to do. And if you decide to become a sustaining member, well, we have lovely things to share with you. Go ahead and do it. Why not? I mean, if you care, if this is important to you, why not support it? I think that it's hard to make collective decisions in a society, and it's hard to, and especially when the mechanism for making a collective decision is missing. deliberately taken away. So the momentum is very hard to change. I notice that from time to time I hear delight expressed when, oh, a symphony shows up and plays in a public square or something like that. We don't support classical music and symphonies in the United States. This is an example of the sort of cultural momentum I'm talking about. In Europe, they do. Absolutely, they do. And so there's a completely different phenomenon for classical music in Europe, where it moves forward. It is 21st century music, and it is possible for many of the citizens in various European states to keep track of, be thrilled by, and move forward with new music that would be utterly confusing, unlistenable, would seem cacophonous to Americans, and Americans miss out because they cannot change this momentum. Despite all the talk about democracy, we do not have it in the United States, and certainly that is evident when it comes to changing the white terror police state that we now live in, with the greatest proportion and numbers of prisoners in the world. Just face that shameful fact for a moment, will you? Please, if you haven't already. And when it comes to the wars, the imperialism, the absolutely unjust, bloody, horrifying, depressing imperialism that the U.S. projects across the world has become momentum. And so I'm trying to give you details that might make you think maybe you need to start to take charge. And when I say you, I mean you collectively. That's the advantage of being behind the mic at a broadcast radio station. I'm saying this to thousands and thousands of people, and I'm saying it to you personally. And there is that that wonderful quality of radio that establishes the cinema, and yet the private room in the mind where these ideas are communicated. Your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187, from The Guardian. Here's some news about North Korea, perhaps that you have not heard. South Korea has proposed that North Korea host some of the skiing events at next year's Winter Olympics in a move it hopes will ease cross-border political tensions. Now, speaking for myself, that's a little different, isn't it? You've been hearing all about the young man who came back comatose. That's grotesque. I suppose he was beaten and starved to death and came back in that state. Who knows where they were coming from in Pyongyang when they sent him back in that state? Maybe it was a threat, or maybe they actually thought it was a peace gesture. I really can't say. But South Korea is interested in peace, of course. Continuing with the article, the South Korean sports minister, Do Jong-won, has also suggested forming an inter-Korean women's ice hockey team to compete at the Games, which open in February in the South Korean town of Pyeongchang. Do cited North Korea's top-class ski resort as a potential venue and said he would discuss co-hosting with Jang Woong, North Korea's delegate to the International Olympic Committee, according to South Korean media. His overture, The Guardian writes, reflects a desire by South Korea's new president Moon Jae-in for cautious engagement with Pyongyang despite anger over its recent missile launches and the death this week of the U.S. university student Otto Warmbier after nearly 17 months in a North Korean prison. Moon suggested earlier this month that two countries lead a Northeast Asian bid to host the 2030 World Cup. North Korean involvement in the tournament would require huge investment in infrastructure, but Moon said if the neighboring countries in Northwest Asia, including North and South Korea, can host the World Cup together, it would help to create peace, end quote. And more of that article at theguardian.com, which you can also reach. I have habits on the web that just stick with me just because I'm getting older, you know. So I put in theguardian.co.uk and it comes out theguardian.com, and I get the U.S. version whether I like it or not. As I said, this is a nation divided. This is a nation with tremendous political momentum because it is and in many ways an anti-democratic nation. When we get together and express our will on the streets, we're likely to be shot at with tear gas and pepper grenades and such things. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. I would like to change topics slightly. Another thing that you can't do much about right now because of the lack of democracy in the United States, article from commondreams.org that I'm going to lean on for this. Oh, by the way, there's two dead so far in the California heat wave. There's fires in Portugal from a heat wave. There's deaths in Britain from a heat wave, and planes have been grounded. American Airlines Bombardier jets have been grounded in Arizona. I guess in the context of war, I should explain, if you don't already know, that Bombardier is a Canadian company and not a description of the capacity of those civilian planes. They're grounded in Arizona because the air is too thin, because the air is too hot, because it's 117 and 119 degrees in Arizona, and even hotter in Needles. And this is going on, and there is a heat wave coming here that will bring the temperature to close to 100 degrees, which is significant for people like me who are old and fat and never got along well with heat. But turning to the article on commondreams.org, as a United Nations agency calls attention to the unusually early heat waves gripping parts of Europe, the Middle East, North Africa, and the U.S., a new study brings an ominous warning about more killer heat near certain to come. In a statement Tuesday, the World Meteorological Organization, citing the recent finding by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, said that the first 5 months of the year were the warmest on the books. And the reason it's phrased that way, speaking for myself, is that the NOAA doesn't belong to you anymore. So the World Meteorological Organization must be turned to analyze the data. Returning to the article, the agency pointed to several examples, such as the extremely high temperatures of around 40 degrees centigrade, that's 104 degrees Fahrenheit, that contributed to the severity of the disastrous wildfire in Portugal, which has claimed dozens of lives, and a heat wave that struck Morocco and brought a record high 109 degrees to one part of the country. Agence France-Presse adds Wednesday that Italy's current heat wave could turn out to be the most intense in 15 years, while Britain was set to see its first five-day stretch of temperatures over 30 degrees, that's over 86 degrees Fahrenheit in June since 1995. And I know it doesn't sound so bad to Americans, but we're way south of Britain, and they're not used to that kind of heat. And if your body's not used to it, then your body's not used to it. But returning to the text, the U.S. Southwest has also been sizzling, as the World Meteorological Organization pointed out. So high were the temperatures in Phoenix on Tuesday, they reached 119, that flights were being canceled. And according to a new global analysis published Monday in the journal Nature Climate Change, deadly heat waves could be faced by nearly three-quarters of humanity by 2100. Here again, I'll speak for myself. I'll bet that's too late a date. I'll bet three-quarters of humanity are going to face deadly heat waves in the next decade. But I'm not a scientist and can't say that. But I am an opinion commenter who has followed the global climate science for decades now, and as I keep saying, there's an acceleration in the acceleration of the phenomena and in the data analyzing it. So we continually hear these dates being moved forward. We are running out of choices for the future. That's a quote of lead author Camila Mora, an associate professor of geography in the College of Social Sciences at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. As the Associated Press explains, Mora's team of researchers examined nearly 2,000 deadly heat waves from around the world since 1980 to look for trends, to define when heat is so severe it kills, and to forecast the future. The data they looked at included the heat wave in Chicago that killed 740 people in 1995, one in Paris that killed 4,800 people in 2003, and a 2010 heat wave in Moscow that killed 10,860 people. That's a quote from NBC News. She explained, "We found this unique threshold of temperature and humidity that allows us to identify why all these people die in these cities around the world. Right now, about one-third of the world's population is exposed to potentially killer heat for at least 20 days a year." And I would explain that they analyze the heat and the humidity. But returning to the article, even if drastic reductions to greenhouse gas are made, nearly half of the world's population will face such heat by 2100, according to the scientists. And if the fossil fuels continue to burn as they are now, about 74% of the population will face potentially deadly heat waves. Mora stated, "For heat waves, our options are now between bad or terrible. An increasing threat to human life from excess heat now seems almost inevitable, but will be greatly aggravated if greenhouse gases are not considerably reduced." And of course, we are now under the sway of the Trump administration, which enthusiastically is gassing away at the Earth's atmosphere. We are threatened directly. Our existence is threatened by 60 million Republicans and their presidents. It's getting towards the top of the hour. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland 90.7 in Cascadia, other frequencies further out, and, pardon me, on KBOO.fm around the world and to all the ships at sea.
Hey, good morning. It is KBOO Portland, your community radio, 1 minute before 10 o'clock. At 10:15, it'll be Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, join us for Between the Covers. Kathleen Stevenson returns to the airwaves, and she welcomes Victoria Stopiello to discuss her collection of essays, This Side of Sand Island, Reflections on Fish, Fins, and Finding Out About the Lower Columbia. And then at 11:30, it's the film show. A visit today to the new Micro Cinema at the Portland International Airport, which features short films and videos by Oregon directors. But stick around, Air Cascadia is up next with headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. That's coming up next. Hey, thanks KBOO members for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Friends of Noise Fest, a daytime music festival Sunday, June 25th at 4 p.m. at Disjecta in Portland. Friends of Noise Fest features 9 bands, including Waterfronts, Glacier Veins, Kuone, Shortline, After Hours, and more. There's also going to be food, art, and an opportunity to learn more about Friends of Noise and their mission to support all ages music spaces in Portland. Again, that's Friends of Noise Fest, Sunday, June 25th at 4 p.m. at Disjecta, 8371 North Interstate Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.